podcast of this episode of Studio 360 is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. Now, podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of Studio 360, PRI shows, and thousands of other programs while on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/studio.
Today in Studio 360... Up on Cripple Creek. Before Robbie Robertson wrote and performed some of the greatest rock songs of the late 60s and 70s, he played backup for Bob Dylan during a time when people were hating Dylan.
Every night we went out there, people booed us and threw stuff at us. It was like being with a war buddy.
But then Robertson and his bandmates went out on their own as the band.
We didn't quite know, but it was a musical revolution that was going to change the course of music forever.
Later, a musical revolution that continues to divide America. A century and a half after the Civil War, we are still fighting over the song Dixie.
It was associated with the Ku Klux Klan, with lynching.
I wish I could quit you, Dixie. Seems like something that American culture would want to say, but it's not going anywhere.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The artist Ai Weiwei is the most world-famous person in China right now. He has also been a witty, troublemaking critic of the regime. But he's mostly been left alone by the authorities. Until now. Ai's studio was suddenly bulldozed earlier this year, which he then declared an artwork. And this month, he's been detained, accused of economic crimes. Last week, one of his protégés was arrested and sentenced to 2 years at hard labor for attending a pro-democracy rally. Allison Clayman is director of an upcoming documentary on Ai Weiwei, which she's been filming since 2008. Allison, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
There had been political references of various fairly subtle kinds in his work before his artwork, but he wasn't what we would consider, now that he's a political prisoner for the time being, a political artist. Tell us about the range of the kinds of work he's done.
Range is definitely a word that has to be used because he has photography and sculpture and, you know, installation works, big installation works. So some of his iconic things have been a triptych where he drops a Han Dynasty urn. It's three photographs where he's holding it and then it smashes. He had been very moved by the Sichuan earthquake, the deaths of so many school children and the collapse of so many schools. And what he first just wanted to do was use the students' names in an artwork. And he was asking around to try and get some of those names. And suddenly he found that the government considered that to be, you know, a state secret. And he thought that was a real slap in the face to the victims and their families. And one of the images that, you know, was ever present was these children's backpacks at the sites of these crumbled, you know, destroyed schools. He took the opportunity of having a solo show at the Munich Museum, Haus der Kunst, and they covered the facade of the museum with children's backpacks in a couple different colors, and the backpack spelled out a sentence that was told to him by the mother of an earthquake victim. It wasn't a political cry. It just simply said she lived happily on this earth for 7 years.
Much of what he was known for before that was sort of witty kinds of things. Like he would take old Chinese bowls and put corporate logos on them?
Sure, he would paint Coca-Cola or he would dip it in industrial paint. Another thing he's really well known for is distorted Chinese furniture, right? That he would use traditional craftsmen and he'd make, you know, a table with two legs on the wall and two legs on the floor.
And going around the world and making rude gestures in famous places.
Yeah, I mean, the original series called Study of Perspective is just him holding up his middle finger to Tiananmen, to the White House, to the Eiffel Tower, but he does that all over the place. And his fans also like to do that as sort of a participatory gesture. There's tens of thousands of people in China who are often younger, who are politically and technologically maybe more savvy, the people that he was engaging with online. And I think that this is a really dark time for them because up until now, they saw him not only as an icon, but someone who was free, you know.
And why was he free for so long? Did something change in what he was doing or in the regime's ideas about where they would draw the line?
I think this is a case where it's the backdrop, the context on which his activities fall that brought about the current state of affairs, because his tone has not changed. Over the years, he's certainly gotten more savvy about how to use the internet, how to sort of organize and creating political documentaries.
And having videographers shoot him as he's being busted and hassled by the authorities.
Yeah. But he wasn't just like someone with a martyr complex or a death wish or something like that. I think that he understands the importance of being free to say things and do things. He isn't really much use to anybody when he's locked up except as a symbol. But at the same time, sometimes he felt like just trotting along and operating within the system. Sometimes I think he felt like you did have to push. But this just shows, I think, a fundamental switch in how the regime tolerates what he does and how they decide to counter it.
If we hadn't, over the last 2 months, seen popular, spontaneous uprisings for democracy in North Africa and all over the Middle East, would this be happening? Or is this, in that context, the Chinese regime decided to say, okay, we can't have anything like this?
That is what it seems, that, you know, there is some amount of reaction and cause and effect because there's been a big crackdown since then and leading up to Ai Weiwei's arrest, because remember, he's not the only person who has been detained or disappeared,
right,
or brought in for questioning. But there's also some degree just of mystery around the upper levels of power within the Communist Party that we all are not privy to, you know.
And no doubt disagreements within those circles.
But frankly, this is a tactic that they've used for a long time. They've ramped it up in the last few weeks, and they've also hit someone who's, you know, of a very, very high profile internationally. But it does seem like this is very connected to the, you know, so-called Jasmine Revolution and events in the Middle East.
How is this going to play out?
Well, it's definitely a moving target. Now we're, you know, 10 days or so out. It doesn't feel like that much more has been illuminated in order to answer that question, because after all, who expected that 10 days out there'd be no word?
And as we're speaking, he hasn't been officially arrested, as the Chinese are very careful to point out.
They have not notified his family, which is also, I think, really disturbing considering he takes medication. I think it still really is too early to tell, and people can see a variety of options that lay in the realm of possibility, but I don't know how optimistic people are.
Thank you very much, Allison.
Sure, thank you.
Allison Clayman is the director of a forthcoming documentary on Ai Weiwei. Bob Dylan just performed in China, and given the crackdown, has gotten some criticism here for doing that. America's great 60s protest figure playing China as Ai Weiwei and other cultural figures are being crushed. But Dylan didn't shy away from playing some of his old political songs there, like this one, Ballad of a Thin Man. When this song came out, I was still just too young to really get Bob Dylan's music. But when his backup band, The Band, went out on their own a few years later, I played their records over and over and over again. The Band's music sounded unlike anyone else's, and their songs told stories. Complex and quirky and authentic and wise and grown up. I was totally smitten as a 15-year-old. Take a load off Fanny. Take a load for free.
Take a load off Fanny. And you put the load right on me.
And when the band performed for the last time in 1976, as chronicled in Martin Scorsese's film The Last Waltz, I had just graduated college and was starting life. It felt like synchronicity. Robbie Robertson was the band's lead guitarist and principal songwriter and most charismatic member. And Robertson is revisiting that part of his life with a new album, his first in more than a decade, called How to Become Clairvoyant. Like the songs from his time with the band, Robertson's new album is filled with rueful stories and quirky American characters, but this time it's more memoir than fiction. One of the main characters is him. We headed straight south in a sundown light on Highway 61 through the Delta night. We share the back roads with card sharks and grifters, tent show evangelists, and look the drifter. What is lost?
I don't know exactly how I got on this path, but being reflective with this much distance just felt very comfortable now. And in the past, I was much more drawn to the mythical, fictional characters and the storytelling. And this is still storytelling, but, I don't mind being in this movie.
And now you're kind of a mythical, quasi-fictional character, I guess.
I've graduated.
The band dissolved more than half your lifetime ago. When you listen to that music today, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down and The Wait and Up on Cripple Creek and Life is a Carnival and all those, what do you think when you hear those songs, if you hear those songs?
Well, just because of the songwriting part of it, that I was really trying to do something special, same thing as what we were just talking about. I thought, wow, Richard could sing this character really good. And then if Levon comes in on the chorus in this part and he takes over the melody and then Rick goes up and sings the higher part, you know what I mean? It was like it was having an extraordinary workshop. And so when I listen to that music now, first I immediately go to that place like, did I do a good job writing that song?
And what's your answer to yourself?
I've done pretty good.
I mean, it was interesting. Not only did I love it at the time, but it doesn't seem in any way dated as so much music from the late 1960s and early 70s can, you know?
I was very much connected to other people making music that it seemed like there was just no expiration date. And whether you're listening to Duke Ellington or listening to Hank Williams, that's what I was drawn to.
Uh-huh.
So it was just a natural thing to not get caught up in what's happening now, man.
I hear you. You had this successful career as a teenager from 16 to 22 as a sideman, and then essentially your big break came by working with Bob Dylan. You were his band as he freaked out his folky bass when he went electric. You were the electric.
Right.
What was that experience like? When, whoa, this is Bob Dylan and everybody suddenly hates him?
First of all, we didn't know very much about folk music and Bob Dylan then. And the idea when people said, you're going electric, we'd always been electric.
Right.
There was no going for us, right? I really liked Bob at that time. You know, he was an interesting character and was doing really cool things, and we were having a wonderful time together. And when you're in the trenches, it was like being with a war buddy,
uh-huh,
almost, because of what we went through. we toured all over North America, Australia, all over Europe, and every night we went out there, people booed us and threw stuff at us. And for us to say, oh, we're just building character here, might have been an illusion, but it did build character, and we didn't quite know, but it was a musical revolution that was going to change the course of music forever. And we would listen to tapes of what we were doing because I was very interested in getting better, because in the beginning, I didn't think we were very good. And I thought, people are, you know, maybe they're right, you know. And everybody was telling Bob, you got to get rid of these guys.
Really? Yeah.
They're ruining everything for you. It's their fault. But when we would listen to these tapes, and we could hear that we were really getting better, and the connection and the music was becoming very solid, finally I got to a place where we're right and they're wrong. Then we did a tour a few years later, and nobody booed.
The world had caught up with you.
The world revolved and changed, and it was an interesting experiment in human terror to say, wow, we stood our ground, and the world came around.
Yeah. Your mother is Native American. Your father is Jewish. Growing up in the 50s in Canada, did you feel like a double exotic, Indian and Jewish? Was that something you were made aware of in any kind of I'm an other kind of person?
Well, back then, it was called It's Better Not to Bring It Up, because it was like a combination that nobody could relate to.
Yes.
You know? Indians couldn't relate to it. Jews couldn't relate to it. Anybody else, forget about it.
And Canadians are too polite to ask.
Right.
Was there a moment as a kid? Was there a moment as a kid in Toronto where you discovered music and decided this is my life?
My musical connection came from the Six Nation Indian Reserve.
Really?
When we would go there, everybody, it seemed to me at that time, played an instrument or sang or danced. And I thought, well, I need to be in the club too.
Uh-huh.
Pretty soon, relatives of mine started showing me, put your finger here and the thing there and then try this. And so that was part of it. And the other part was the elders telling stories. And I also said, I want to be able to do that, too.
Huh.
I want to be able to tell a story, and everybody just listens, and they're getting chill bumps listening to these stories.
Good training. Both the storytelling, songwriting training and the musical training, right?
Yep.
And then was there a moment when you started hearing R&B or whatever it was that connected you to what was playing on the radio?
Well, by the time I reached puberty, I had a guitar. I was standing at the crossroads. And
so to speak.
And yeah. And I've got a guitar in my hand. I've just become very interested in girls. And all of a sudden, out of the radio comes this sound called rock and roll. It was like a setup.
Yeah. No, it sounds like an unbelievable scene in your biopic.
Yeah.
What if the surviving members of the band called you up and said, yeah, bygones be bygones, let's get together and put on a show. Would that interest you?
Well, I don't know if putting on shows interest me at all with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Garth is so extraordinary and Levon's so extraordinary. I would never say never to working with these guys. They're my brothers. I love these guys. And there is no, from my end, there's no bygones or anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What we went through together, you know, there's no way to replace that.
Robbie Robertson, thank you very much.
This was fun. Thank you.
Robbie Robertson's new album is called How to Become Clairvoyant. You can hear more of our conversation at studio360.org. And while you're there, check out our Facebook page and Twitter feeds. We've got new coverage of arts and pop culture for you every day.
In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the people were saying...
Coming up...
Oh, I wish I was in a land of cotton.
Dixie. It's been a hit for more than 150 years, and it continues to drive people crazy.
When I heard the song, that caused conflict within me. Music tends to do that. It stirs the emotion.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Sing it, fellas.
Stay with us.
Oh, I wish I was in Dixie.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It's been 150 years since the beginning of the Civil War, and most of the ephemera from that age is in museums. Posters, uniforms, photographs, all behind glass. But two symbols of the Confederacy are alive and kicking, the Stars and Bars, and a song that's still as hot today as it was then. You've heard it on television, maybe even walking down the street. Dixie. It is an American icon. And we asked Studio 360's Trey Kay to find out where Dixie came from and why it continues to divide Americans.
On April 4th, 1859, while the clouds of war were gathering in America, Bryant's minstrel show, performing at a Broadway theater in New York City, was about to inject one of the most memorable and ultimately most controversial songs into the nation's bloodstream.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my pleasure to present a new ballad written by Mr. Tambo, and I must say, against the advice of his friends. It is entitled Dixie.
This scene, from a 1943 film called Dixie, starring Bing Crosby, tries to recreate the song's debut.
I wish I was in the land of cotton, old times done and not forgotten. Look away.
Did you catch that? When Crosby, who is in blackface, sings Old Times Dar Am Not Forgotten, he's imitating a slave dialect, as written by a white man from Ohio.
It's a white person dressed as a black person longing for the plantation South.
That's Coleman Hutchison, professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He devotes a lot of ink to Dixie in his book, Apples of Ashes, Literature, Nationalism, and the Confederate States of America.
The idea is that this person who's singing is away from Dixie, which we understand to be somewhere in the South, and that the person is really crying out to be back there, wishing that they could be back, nostalgically wishing they could be back on the plantation, way, way, way down south in Dixie.
This is why many people have always regarded Dixie as racist. With its happy depiction of plantation life, it seems to apologize for slavery. We can't say precisely who wrote Dixie. Daniel Decatur Emmett, a white minstrel songwriter, most often gets the credit. But Coleman Hutchison and other scholars think that he might have lifted parts of it from African-American folk tradition and invented verses of his own.
One of the things that Emmett's most famous for is his ability to record the purported sounds and rhythms of black speech. So this is a man who made his money arranging and writing songs that would stereotype and in some ways mock African-American speech patterns, African-American culture.
Dixie went viral. And although the North and the South were about to go at each other's throats, whites all over the U.S. loved Dixie. Abraham Lincoln had the song played at his inauguration. When the Confederates were voting on secession, the band played Dixie after each vote in favor. And when Jefferson Davis was inaugurated, the song was arranged to a quick-step beat, something you could sing while marching off to war. And it got lots of new verses.
Southerns, hear ye country call ye, up lest worse than death befall ye. Two arms, in Dixie.
This is a Confederate version. It pledges to live or die for Dixie. It was recreated by a musician named Bobby Horton.
Advance the flag of Dixie, hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand and live or die for Dixie.
And the Union had their answer. Again, here's Bobby Horton.
Away down south in the land of traitors, rattlesnakes and alligators, right away, come away, right away, come away. Where captains, king, and men are chattels, Union boys will win the battles, right away, come away, right away.
Each Dixie boy must understand that he must mind his Uncle Sam.
Away, each Dixie boy must understand that he must mind his Uncle Sam. Away.
But that Yankee version didn't stick. A Northerner may have written Dixie, but it perfectly captured the warm sentiment Southerners felt for their homeland, even if they didn't live in cotton country. Dan Emmett, a Union man, was none too pleased.
So he will say on a number of occasions that he wished he'd never written the damn song in the first place, because if he had only known what the Confederates would do with it, if he'd only known what Southerners would claim with his song.
When the Bloody War finally came to a close, Lincoln asked the band to play Dixie at victory celebrations. Coleman Hutchison reads the remarks that Lincoln made at one occasion.
I thought Dixie one of the best tunes I ever heard. I had heard that our adversaries over the way had attempted to appropriate it. I insisted yesterday that we had fairly captured it. I presented the question to the Attorney General, and he gave the opinion that it is our lawful prize. I ask the band to give us a good turn upon it.
It sounds like Lincoln is sticking his vanquished enemies in the eye. But Coleman Hutchison sees it a little differently.
I think he's really reaching out there, yes, to tweak the South a little bit, yes, to acknowledge that the Union had won, but also acknowledging a certain common culture in which the president of the Union, who has just brought to the end the bloodiest war then known to mankind, can also acknowledge an affection for the South and a willingness to work to bring it back together.
But Lincoln was wrong. The North had indeed won the war, but it couldn't claim Dixie. In the Reconstruction era, as Southerners became nostalgic for the antebellum way of life, they got even more attached to Dixie. Confederate heritage organizations decided on a standard version based on Emmett's original verses. But they made one important change. They removed the corny slave dialect because it wasn't about slave life anymore. It was more about Southern pride. Long into the 20th century, Dixie was popular throughout the nation, sort of like Gone with the Wind. But as the civil rights movement began to make inroads in America, Dixie was a front in a new battle. The Virginia Military Institute is in Lexington, Virginia, situated in the majestic Blue Ridge Mountains. Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee are buried close by.
When you passed Lee's tomb, you were required to salute the flag. And I know the way I got out of that is that I very seldom passed Lee's tomb.
That's Colonel Philip Wilkerson, retired from the U.S. Army.
I attended VMI as one of the first five African-American cadets.
Every May, VMI has a commemoration ceremony for its cadets who died in the Battle of New Market during the Civil War. They helped secure a Confederate victory. For about 100 years, Dixie was a part of that ceremony.
The negative connotation that Dixie held for me, it was associated with the Ku Klux Klan, it was associated with lynching, it was associated with mistreatment of individuals, not only blacks, but Jews and a bunch of that caused conflict within me. Hearing, when I heard the song, music tends to do that, tends to motivate, it stirs the emotion. Those are the emotions that I felt. It caused the conflict.
In 1973, after Wilkerson graduated, the student body voted to eliminate Dixie from the Newmarket ceremony.
One song does not take away from the valor of those cadets. The student body realized what's more important, playing a old, outdated song or keeping cohesion within the Institute. And I think clearly cohesion within the Institute took precedence.
And this, in the eyes of some, is tantamount to cultural genocide.
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive. It's a form of cultural genocide in that it's stamping out a culture that really is not a threat to anyone.
Glenn McConnell is a South Carolina state senator. When the Citadel, another famous military college, stopped playing Dixie at sporting events in the 1990s, McConnell was critical.
If we become intolerant and we start excluding things, we're on a slippery slope. And it eventually erodes that part of history, that part of the culture. Racism has occurred north and south and everywhere. And you can't change what occurred, but you can grow from it. And I don't think growing from it is excluding it. Because what happens is when you deny somebody that which they cherish, then that builds up resentment. And that's just not a good way to go. I just think the cement of a free society is toleration and incorporation.
I'm Carol Mosley Braun. In 1993, I was the United States Senator from Illinois.
In 1993, Carol Mosley Braun was the only African-American in the United States Senate. She was locked in a power struggle with Jesse Helms over the Confederate flag. It was a technicality having to do with the patent on the flag, but symbolically, it was big. And Mosley Braun was winning the fight against the legendary Jesse Helms.
The next day, I was on the Senate elevator with Senator Hatch and Senator Dodd, and the door opened and Senator Helms started to come onto the elevator, and he said to Orrin Hatch, he said, "I'm going to make her cry. I'm going to sing Dixie until she cries." And I responded, "Senator, you could sing Rock of Ages and I would cry." Did I take it as a jocular kind of, you know, let's be friends? No, it was not. It was intended to be hostile, and it was intended to be aggressive. I don't mean to speak ill of the dead because, as you know, he's dead now. But the fact of the matter is that he was part of a cadre of senators who had made a career out of fanning the flames of racial antipathy and antagonism and using that as a way of building their own constituency by exploiting racism.
Can Dixie ever shed that Jesse Helms fanning the flames baggage? The controversy isn't fading. In 2009, the University of Mississippi banned the song, but Coleman Hutchison, the University of Texas historian, thinks that we should be careful about dropping Dixie, even if we find it offensive.
By listening to, by studying Dixie, I think we get an extraordinary opportunity to see the history of the last 150 years, from blackface minstrelsy to the inauguration of Barack Obama. Dixie has been a major cultural thread that can connect those disparate historical moments.
Hutchison thinks that Elvis had the right idea. Yes, Elvis Presley. Elvis began performing a version of Dixie in the early 1970s. But the arrangement, by songwriter Mickey Newberry, gave Dixie a chaser, the battle hymn of the Republic.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Beautiful performances like Elvis's help us to continue to have an ongoing relationship with the song, help us to continue to find a place for it in our lives, our ways of thinking about the U.S. South, about the nation, about slavery, about racism. You know, I wish I could quit you, Dixie. Seems like something that American culture would want to say to this song, but it's not going anywhere.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kidd.
Elvis is hard to beat, but you can listen to different versions of Dixie at studio360.org. While you're there, check out the other American icons in our series, The Great Gatsby, Superman, I Love Lucy, and many more. That's studio360.org. And speaking of American icons, the board game Monopoly used to represent the American capitalist dream. But we've decided it's time to reinvent the game.
What if the government decided to regulate the railroads?
Redesigning Monopoly, that's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Don't you know each cloud contains...
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Monopoly, the board game, has been around for nearly all of our lifetimes. I must have spent hundreds of hours playing it as a kid after graduating from Candyland, but before I discovered Risk. There are now countless versions of Monopoly for different cities, and there's a major change coming to the main game this fall.
Welcome to Monopoly Live.
Hasbro's new version will replace the paper play money with ATM cards and a computer. No more tucking bills under your leg or the edge of the board. But is adding a computer chip to the same old game gonna make it contemporary? Capitalism and real estate development in America have changed a little bit since the 1930s. So Studio 360 has launched a Monopoly makeover. We want your ideas about how to reinvent and redesign Monopoly. Send them to studio360.org, and we'll give those ideas to game designer Brenda Brathwaite. Brenda is, not to put too fine a point on it, the queen of video games. And she also designs smart, artful board games. Like me, she started off as a Monopoly devotee.
Yeah, I mean, Monopoly was one of my first games. I still have my original Monopoly game. My super brainy friends would come over to my house and we would play board games on, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night. I guess the more I learned about games, the less I liked the game as a play experience, because at some point the game is literally just about waiting for people to run out of money and perish.
Yes.
And the only person who's having any fun is the one person who's causing this destruction.
Yes, you are one of two people, either the person who's winning and you're enjoying that, or the person who's bored and can't wait for it to end.
And that's not fun, considering this can go on for hours. I went off the edge one year and actually created an Excel spreadsheet that if you just hit F9, it would tell you who won the game, because it's all based on random rolls, right?
And right.
Based on the random rolls, you hit F9 and it'll just tell you who wins the game. And so I thought this would allow us to hasten our Monopoly portion of Thanksgiving. But of course, nobody in my family is a geeky game designer like me. It wasn't appreciated for the genius that I thought it was.
Well, it's a funny piece of conceptual art, if nothing else. Hasbro seems to understand the long game problem. I see that they have recently put out versions that you can play special length. You have control over the length of the game, and you can have a 30-minute version or a 60-minute version. So obviously they have heard this complaint.
Well, but what they're really doing there in addressing the different lengths of time, what they're really doing, it seems to me, is putting a Band-Aid on the real problem. And the real problem is that it creates sort of an empire, right? That somebody's going to win. And so basically all they're trying to do is hasten the deaths of the other players. And the better way to do it, you'll find that the games that come out of Germany, they have a lot of catch-up mechanics in them. So there's an opportunity for, you know, a Facebook to rise, to go back to this monopoly thing. There's an opportunity for MySpace to be dethroned. There's an opportunity for this Google to appear out of the Yahoo. What happens in monopoly really runs counter to the entire thing that we talk about is the American dream.
Right.
And there's thousands of people, millions of people who still believe that they can come here and with nothing they can rise to, you know, great somethings.
So, for instance, in the case of monopoly, once Atlantic City is built out, maybe you could have a means to start Las Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of opportunity, but I think in redesigning Monopoly, the thing that I would love is to actually enjoy the play experience all the way to the end, because that's what I'm there for.
Speaking of Facebook, we asked our listeners to begin throwing in their suggestions and their ideas for how we might reinvent or redesign the game. A lot of people seem to be attached to the pieces and the using a shoe, a little metal shoe as your game piece.
This pieces and parts are super fun to play with.
Right.
And I think it offers a great experience there too.
But Danielle Flood of Miami says, the game needs crooked Florida developers going to jail and an oil spill to affect beachfront property. And actually, as I've thought about it and trying to imagine what a 21st century business, real estate, investment, monopoly game should be, I mean, I think it really, truly could be more contemporary in terms of having more leverage and bigger loans. I mean, right now, when you play Monopoly, if you've mortgaged your property, you get no rent. That doesn't sound like real life to me.
Right. You know, it's... You know, I actually think she's totally right. You know, all the random acts of God are just the acts of crooks. All these things that would really affect a situation and could potentially cause a total turnaround. Or what if the government decided to regulate the railroads?
Yes.
Or they decided to suddenly sponsor them. And if you happen to land there, they would pay you regularly. There's so many different things that could happen in a game that would be way more contemporary.
Well, and it strikes me that the bank as this neutral... simply taking and giving your money operation. What? That's not how I see banks playing the game these days. I mean, it seems to me you could it would be more complicated, but have the bank be an active gamer.
Oh, see, that's an interesting thing I hadn't thought about. I think there's not an American alive who doesn't know that banks are way different now than they used to be just, 10 years ago.
Exactly. Well, we will check back in a few weeks with some ideas you've had in the meantime and feed you the various ideas that our listeners send us. We'll get back to you and see how it's coming along.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I bet you no one play me in Monopoly, though. I came from Baltimore and moved to Tennessee. And now I'm sitting boardwalk with some hotels. Yeah, I'm a Parker brother. I guess money. And my dad owned that game, so I'm the bank teller. Monopoly, money,
get Monopoly. And what do you think the 21st century Monopoly ought to look like, be like? We're taking your suggestions right now at studio360.org. New player pieces? A never get out of jail card? We'll feature some of the best of your innovations on our show, and Brenda Brathwaite will incorporate them into a new design for the game. Let's be clear, we are not talking about a Hasbro edition of Monopoly. Submit your ideas at studio360.org now through May 1st.
How the hell did the shoe get in there, man? The guy must have got drunk the second night he was working on the game, you know?
Let's put in a shoe.
I hide all the 500s.
I get Monopoly money.
When you think of a Western, you think guns, horses, wide open spaces, covered wagons, cowboys and Indians. The new movie Meek's Cutoff has all those elements, but it's a very different kind of Western because it's so realistic. It's about three families traveling west in 1845 on the brand new Oregon Trail. They've hired a guide, a mountain man, who claims to know a shortcut through the Cascade Mountains to the Pacific. But as the terrain gets drier and rockier and the water runs out, they realize they're in big trouble.
Sometimes I get the sense you don't care for me much, Miss Tetherell.
Oh, I have no feelings one way or the other, Mr. Meek.
That's just a kind way of saying you don't like me.
I don't like where we are.
So that's what you think, that we're lost?
I'd say that seems about the right word for it.
We're not lost. We're not lost. We're just finding our way.
I certainly hope so.
We're gonna make it all right.
Oh, you don't need to patronize me, Mr. Meek.
Well, now, I think you're flirting with me, ma'am.
You don't know much about women, do you, Stephen Meek?
Well, I know something or other.
If you say so.
That's Bruce Greenwood playing Stephen Meek, who, by the way, was a real-life guide in the West, and Michelle Williams as Emily Tetherow, the tough heroine of the film. The director of Meek's Cutoff is Kelly Reichert. She is drawn to stories of Americans who've lost their way and find themselves in tough circumstances, like in her last two films, Wendy and Lucy and Old Joy. Meek's Cutoff is Reichert's first Western, but she doesn't want to see it that way.
The whole time we were making the film, I really stayed away from the word Western, just to really keep the expectations of the actors sort of at bay of what you would anticipate of how the film was going to be shot. You know, I mean, the American Western, this is a genre of these super heightened moments of excitement and gunplay. And when you read these journals, especially the women's journals, you get this different point of view of what the journey was like. And it's a much more trance-like. One day bleeds into the next. The repetitiveness of the chores, the living in a community but being really lonely a lot of the time. Yeah. When reading the journals of people and they're just departing Missouri and they're
Which was the jumping off point for everybody.
Exactly. You sort of met up in Missouri and took off. At first, the descriptions of, you know, landscape and stories, you know, the writing is really full and poetic and romantic about what they're up to. And then as the journey goes on, the journals get really stripped down. Like the women's journals are a list of chores, and the men's journals might be the directions of, the you know, cross the river four times today. You know, things just become list. And that's where we catch up with our travelers.
Well, which goes to the fact that you went to such length for authenticity of various kinds. I mean, authentic props, actual 1840s wagons as opposed to fake 1870s wagons or whatever, historically accurate fabrics, coffee grinder apparently from the period, all these things. Why?
We got really into the research of it, and we had a week of Pioneer Camp before we shot where the actors came out and our production designer set up in this airplane hangar outside of Burns, this sort of almost like a little store where each family came and got their goods for their wagon and loaded up their wagon. And they learned how to pitch a tent and start fire without matches and load the guns, fire the guns, cook bread in the ground. So all these things are really time consuming. So we, the production, by shooting in these really hard to get to places and harder to get to with oxen, and having all these, you know, the wagons of the period and all the tools of the period, it slowed us down. You know, just we had to struggle with what was there, you know.
That and put you more in sync with the people?
I think so. As much, you know, we went home and slept in a bed at night. We didn't roll under the wagon, so I'm not saying it's the same ride.
And you knew where you were, more or less.
So most of the time.
Yeah. If it's not too rude, how much do your movies cost to make?
Well, we shot Old Joy for $30,000, and then we raised the remaining money. It was an $80,000 film. And Wendy and Lucy, I think, was around 100 or 120. I can't remember exactly.
Those are astoundingly small numbers. That's like a small off-Broadway play.
I mean, it's a lot of somebody's money. To me, that's a lot of money. But, you know, we're stretched pretty thin. And it really takes a commitment from cast and crew to get yourself into this kind of...
Especially when you have stars like Michelle Williams.
Michelle Williams is a very game person. I mean, you either find some joy in the hardship of it, because, you know, what's really beautiful about it and the camaraderie and what you're in for really is mixed up in what's really hard about it. Sometimes, you know, I just... look at my crew, you know, in a rainstorm at 3 a.m. and, you know, out there hustling, or in the case of Meek's Cutoff, which was just so strenuous. I mean, my second camera woman, Eliza, who is tough as nails and not a complainer, you know, came up to me at one point and just said, I'm never not in pain. And she wasn't complaining. She was just stating a fact, and then she went on working. And I know it was accurate. And, you know, it's overwhelming to get that kind of just commitment from people and people caring so much.
There are artful, ambitious directors like Gus Van Sant or Steven Soderbergh who make little tiny, strange movies as well as great big budget Hollywood movies. If somebody came to you and said, yeah, here's $25 million to make a movie, this movie, do you have any interest in that?
It's a trick question.
Not intended as one.
Right. Well, if you can point to me a female filmmaker having that career.
So you think it's either one or the other for women somehow uniquely, that it's either you're going to be Nancy Myers or you're going to be you.
I'm just saying that I don't see a woman director having the career of a Gus Van Sant or a Todd Haynes or a Spike Jonze or a Noah Baumbach or a Wes Anderson. I don't know who that woman is.
But you don't feel constrained about the kinds of stories you can tell and movies you can make?
I don't. Not so far, but I mean, it could happen. But also, I do think that for any filmmaker, man or woman, whoever you are, the more money you take, you can't make films as privately take more money. So there is that trade-off.
Kelly Reichert, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kelly Reichert's new movie is called Meek's Cutoff, and it's out now.
I'm gonna pack my wife and kids. I'm gonna hit that western road. I'm gonna hit that Oregon Trail. It's coming fall.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you listen again next week. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Eric Malinsky,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Katie Palmer,
Mary Du.
Special thanks this week to Mark Phillips and, as ever, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360... The cool rock stars are no longer trashing their hotel rooms. Now they're trying to save the environment.
We go back to the hotel room and figure out how much green energy credits we have to do instead of figuring out how many lines we're going to snort or something like that.
All kinds of creative minds go green. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.